following recording is for Phyllis Cutineau for the Pew Charitable Trust on Tuesday, July 24th, 2012 at 9 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. Thank you for your patience in holding. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Phyllis Cutineau. Ma'am, you may begin.
Okay. Well, again, thanks and welcome to everybody. I'm Phyllis Cutineau. I direct the Clean Energy Program here at the Pew Charitable Trust on the Project on National Security, Energy, and Climate. And perhaps before we get started, you might want to introduce yourself so that they don't have to log down and want to know who you are, if that makes sense. So can we take a moment to do that? Keith, do you want to start?
Yeah, I'm Keith Johnson. I'm with the Wall Street Journal. I cover energy and security issues.
Thanks. I'm Julia Piper with Climate Wire, part of the publishing.
I'm Andrew Rostushin with Politico.
I'm Suzanne Goldenberg from The Guardian.
Great. Adam Pupel.
Yeah.
Also with Pew.
And Matt Carr with Biotechnology Industry Organization, just back from Hawaii and launched the Great Green Fleet.
Yay.
I'm Andrea Widener. I'm from Chemical and Engineering News.
Okay.
Amy Snyder with GreenWire.
I'm Dave Alexander from Reuters.
Great. And then we have folks on the phone.
On the phone, we have Lee Morgan with the San Diego Union Tribune, Jill Buck with VOA's Go Green Radio, Sandra Irwin with National Defense Magazine, Andy Chow with Hannah News, Deborah Atlas with Record Searchlight, John Nolan with Dayton Daily News, and Mr. Kaufman with the Desert Sun.
Great. Okay. Well, just a little bit about the Pew Project before we begin. We launched the Pew Project in 2009, and its purpose is to examine the intersection between national security and our energy posture. We were honored to have Senator Warner, upon his retirement from the United States Senate, join us. And the project and Senator Warner have logged more than 20,000 miles around the country, visiting 26 states, where we've been talking to a lot of voters and also members of the media about the intersection between our energy posture and national security. We've also chronicled the kind of policies and approaches and efforts of the Department of Defense when it comes to energy, and we've actually been to see plenty of bases firsthand. We have been to Quantico, we've been to McGill Air Force Base, we've been to the Air Force Academy, we've been up to Naval Portsmouth, Fort Bragg, and we've even been on an amphibious assault ship. I think, Annie, you might have come to that event. So we've been able to, very fortunate to see a lot of kind of these energy innovations firsthand. And our last report, which hopefully some of you have seen, read, you know, every single page and word of, was from the Barracks to the Battlefield, which really looked at energy innovation in three areas. So energy efficiency, advanced biofuels, and then renewable energy on bases. And that's, energy innovation is really what brings us all here today. It's our purpose. We're going to hear from Senator Warner, who's going to kick it off, and then we're going to move to General Jackson, and then General Tassala, and I think they're all going to certainly address the letter that's being released and the imperative for energy innovation and the appropriate role of the Defense Department. I can only speak for myself when I say that I think we've been dismayed at some efforts by members of Congress and the politicization of some of these efforts. I think, you know, there certainly is an imperative when it comes to clean energy, but that's something that perhaps we could address later. So everyone's going to make short remarks, and then we're going to spend lots of time for Q&A, and we'll try and manage, of course, to get the folks on the phone as well. So anyway, with that, I'll kick it off to Senator Warner.
Thank you, Phyllis. It's been a great experience for me to part of your team and being sort of a corporal in your rear round field, charge on behalf of energy and so forth. Recently in the nation's capital, we experienced one of the severe periods of 100-degree weather. And it was interesting for me, I'm having been raised in this area in Northern Virginia and elsewhere, to watch how the city reacted. I mean, hotels had to shut down, our home lost air conditioning. Everybody sort of did a makeshift, missed their work and one thing or another because of this perturbation in our energy supply for the capital of the United States and the environment. Well, when it comes to the military, they've got to have a far greater degree of certainty. They don't have the luxury of, all right, we can't do this operation, we'll just shut down for a while or move here or do that. They have got to have certainty. And I commend the successive Secretaries of State, Bob Gates, whom I've known very well for many years, worked with him, now Leon Panetta, focusing on the need for the entirety of the department, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, in having programs to be able to have a highest degree attainable of certainty of their energy supplies when they need it. Now, Phyllis mentioned Capitol Hill. I've had a little experience there over 30 years as a U.S. Senator before joining Pew. We go through these evaluations. That's the responsibility of the Congress. But now our responsibility here at Pew and with the private sector across America is to sit down and work with Congress to try and come up with that legislative program that enables the Department of Defense to continue what it's done for years, namely, been innovators in seeking solutions as to how to meet their requirements to perform their missions 24/7. And part of that program has involved the experimentation and proof of the use and viability of alternative fuels. And today we're going to focus a little bit on comments that were made by the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Pleener, and I had the privilege of introducing him when he spoke to some 50 senior staff members of the committees of Congress, primarily Armed Services, a few days ago. And I stood there as he talked about the variety of things the Department of Navy, and as we emphasize Navy, similar innovation is taking place in Air Force, Army, and Marine Corps. He talked about their operational energy efficiency program and how they're holding their commanding officers of their base structure, their ships at sea, and other commands to concentrate 24/7 on how to conserve the use of energy. They go on and speak about how they're going into all-electric propulsion of the new class of ships. They discussed the hybrid electric drive of the Arleigh Burke class. Now, the Arleigh Burke class, I was privileged to be here on Pennsylvania Avenue when Arleigh Burke came up and opened the Navy Center and the ship. I went to the commissioning of his ship. I was privileged to meet that famous sailor many, many years ago. But in 2015, they're going to ship that class of ships to the hybrid electric drive. I'm going to talk about, since 2003, they have reduced energy use ashore by more than 14%. Example, metering of the consumption of energy on the bases. Energy security reduces dependence on the commercial grid, how they're dealing with that issue. Moving on to the key, research and development. R&D investments, innovations reduce risk in future warfighting capability. The Navy Department, I have to say, has been a leader under Secretary Mabus and then a succession, Admiral Ruffhead, and now CNO Greener. R&D, they need $11 million in FY13 funding to continue the testing and qualification. Results will inform our course and speed and future. Alternative fuels are an important option. They mitigate the risk associated with the petroleum market, where $1 increase in price of oil represents a $30 million impact on the Navy budget under which they're operating. Goes on about the energy efficiency and so forth, but I like the way he concludes, Navy is a leader in any energy innovation. And he goes back historically to talk about how this innovation started in 1950 when DOD has used the Defense Production Act, Title III, to support numerous times industrial production capacity for critical needs. I'd like to have our guest talk a moment about the Great Green Fleet, what you saw, if you would. But we're at that point where they need $11 million to continue for one more fiscal year. That testing and evaluation to prove the drop-in fuels, be it in aviation units, surface units, and the like. But the Green Fleet, I think, is going to come back with a case study proving it worked as planned. But they've got to look to the future. And the future, to get through the proven establishment of the use of biofuels, for example, in fleet operations, to where it can be priced at a market that's compatible and competitive with the fossil fuel market. And that can only be done, in my judgment, and I think it's true in the department, through a combination of joint efforts by government, private sector, and the respective armed forces. So with that, I'll yield the floor to our distinguished guest panel, and they will make their presentations. And the one question I can answer, and I tell you, I've worked with Pew, and we've had many, many prominent retired generals and admirals in the Navy working with us. But today, we end up with three Marines. Here on my right are two men who've given their lives, literally 30-plus years, as careers. I was in the Marines for a period during the Korean War, profited by greatly as an individual, the training I received, the friendships I made, and it literally solidified the foundation of whatever career I've been able to achieve in my modest lifetime of 85 years. I yield the floor.
General Jackson?
How do you follow that? I know you all have some biographical data on me, so I won't go into that, but I just retired January 1st, and so I'm getting used to having hair, so if I scratch my head a little bit, you know, because stuff is new on top of my head. But
just be glad you got.
Touché. It's kind of interesting why I'm here and why I'm so passionate about this. When I retired, I said I'm not going to really work, but I will take on things that I'm passionate about. And through the years, you know, this has become a passion. Whether it was 1973 when I was waiting as a civilian, waiting in gas lines in California so I could get my allocated 10 gallons of gasoline, which was then priced at 39 cents a gallon, by the way, and as a result of the Yom Kippur War and the oil embargo. So we got a strategic message in 1973 that our industrial base, our military base, could easily be threatened by a lack of fossil fuels coming out of the Mideast. And we did nothing. And then in August of 1990, I was a young... Well, I was an old major, and I was given my first assignment. I'd been in the Pentagon for 2 weeks, and I was put in the operations directorate, the J3, of the Pentagon. And I was told to do some studying because I was going to be this emergency action officer. But as long as you're doing your studying, why don't you sit out in the Europe, Middle East, Africa desk? Nothing's really going on in the Middle East, and it'll give you lots of time to study. We've got Liberia going on, okay? And we've gotten some reports that Saddam was on the border of Kuwait. And he was making threatening gestures. He wanted $5 billion or something like that, and access
to Kuwaiti oil. And, you know, that the CIA, the DIA, everybody started looking at this. Oh, he's not really going to do it. He's just saber-rattling. And so every time a message would come in from the Middle East, Africa, Europe, I would take it and I'd put it in Colin Powell's box or General Kelly's box, the director of the operations director. I'd put it in everybody's box. I'd look at the message from the embassies, look at it from the four-star commands out there, and I'd put it in the appropriate box and go back to my study. Well, on a night of August the 2nd, 1990, I come in early, fill up my coffee cup. The guy who I'm going to relieve, he's very excited that I'm there early. And he says, nothing's going on, DIA, CIA. No, Saddam's not going to come over the border. That's the report. So the phone rings. He says, well, you're here. You might as well answer it. And so I pick up the phone. And there's an excited voice on it, an accent I don't recognize. And he's trying very hard to say something to me as fast as he can. And, you know, I do my typical, hey, this is Major General Jackson, National Military Command Center. May I help you, ma'am and sir? And then there's that blur of an accent that I can't hear a single word through the handset. I say, sir, if you just slow down, speak real slow, I'll be able to help you, maybe. And he slows down in a heavy Arabic accent, and he says, the Iraqis are here. I am at the American Embassy in Kuwait City. We need help. And I said, just a minute. You need a general. So I took the phone over to General Hoskowitz, another Marine, because he was the senior officer of the watch that night. This is about 10 p.m. civilian time. And the next thing you know, General Powell, everybody is in. There's a galaxy of stars around there. And they said, Major, you look big enough. You go guard that door. So I guarded the door and made sure they had coffee all through the night. Before I got home that night, F-15 tanker aircraft were all on the way, in the airflow, on the way to Saudi Arabia. That was August 2nd. I came home. I told my wife, honey, we're at war. We have been, since 1990, 22 years, in the next 10 days or so, involved in armed conflict in the Middle East. We know that the Iraqi war cost us about 5,000 American lives, and Kuwait has cost us, or Afghanistan has cost us close to 2,000. So I look at this, I grew up as an infantry officer. I've deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq. I even deployed to the Philippines, chasing Abu Sayyaf, a shoot-off from Al-Qaeda. The cost in our lack of response to the chokehold both on our national defense and our national economy of oil has been a great deal more expensive than we like to say, both in blood and the military establishment, which we've had to create, the development of Central Command, the development of the fleet and the Navy Central Command, our cost in war and war materials. That's the true cost of fossil fuels from the Middle East. There is no price that you can add to a gallon of gas, which we pay $4 in California for. I don't know what the rest of the country pays. A gallon for regular. But there's no blood cost on that. There's no cost additive to the defense budget on that. And so when I look at our lethargy since 1973, and now we have raised, if you were born in 1990, you have only known your nation at war in the Middle East. That's all you know. The kids we have in Afghanistan lead the charge right now. We're in 2001 at 9/11. Those young Marines and soldiers and sailors and airmen were in the sixth grade. All volunteers, but they're paying a price for our lack of innovation, for our lack of doing the research and development of alternatives to Middle East fossil fuel. So they are patriotic and they're fighting for the right reasons in their hearts and in their minds. But the reality is, We have done nothing. And, you know, in my kind of historical perspective of this, I go all the way back to the Founding Fathers. And if you look at the preamble of the Constitution, it says that one of the reasons why government was established was to ensure the blessings of posterity to our posterity. Blessings of liberty to our posterity. That's the generations to come. So we haven't invested enough for the generations to come. And as a result, our generations now that we're raising and leading are paying a heavy price. And so the Department of Defense, at my last command, I was the commanding general of Marine Corps Installations West, which means I had oversight of all of the bases west of the Mississippi. And I came in that command in 2009. And about the same time, the Secretary of the Navy, Secretary Mavis, had brought together all the admirals and generals and said, we have got to do something for that posterity. And because we're the largest consumer of fossil fuels of any government agency and probably most corporations in America, if not the world, we have got to lead the charge on that. And so every time we built a new house, every time we constructed something, we took on the leadership in energy and development kind of standards, the LEED standards. And so, and they're from silver to gold to platinum. Now we're building platinum buildings. When I had command as a colonel, we were trying to figure out how to pay the bill for electricity. And now we're generating electricity. One of our bases in California just took a garbage dump. Took the methane off the garbage dump, which reduced the carbon footprint. At the same time, it gives the base 50% of its electrical requirements now. Just the methane burning off the nuclear station. We know we can do better, okay? And so, and if we don't want to spend the lives of the next generation defending the pipelines of oil tankers coming out of the Middle East, we need to continue on the research and development to the point where, as the senator has said, that we can, that it becomes an alternative fuel. Whether it's the cooking grease from McDonald's or Jack in the Box, or whether it's the solar or wind, we have got to continue to advance this so that the next generation are not protecting pipelines for the country. And we're spending a 19-year-old's precious life in that regard. So that's kind of the take, and that's why I can make it a passion, because I've been there, and if you've ever looked, it doesn't matter what color your skin, what your ethnic background, when you bleed out the desert sand, it's purple. And that's the true cost to America, not $15 a gallon or $26 a gallon. If you put a price on that, we've got to do it all. That's my opinion.
You know, it's my honor to be here and be with these other two gentlemen. Tony, when I was a two-star and he was a brand-new selected Brigadier General, I had the opportunity to promote him, and we were down at the Central Command. I was working for John Appzade, and Tony had the Marine Forces, or Deputy Commander for Marine Forces Central Command. And Senator Warner, I headed up Marine Aviation and then put together the Marine Corps budget and tried to execute it. And I spent a lot of time over in front of his desk when he was over on the hill. Always respected what he did. And a lot of times I came out of there with my pants on fire, but I appreciated, you know, your guidance and those that you were with. And I think, you know, I joined with Tony, with the senator, and many others when we talk about, hey, we must reduce our the vulnerability that we have at the strategic, operational, and tactical level that our dependence on fossil fuels generates. We're seeing all across the military, and it's not just about biofuel, continuing to purchase. It's also about efficiencies. You know, you got Marines and soldiers out at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. They're being taught how to drive vehicles
not only tactically, but how do you do it and reduce the use of fuel? I think one of the most articulate, sometimes blunt, and sometimes he says things he tries to take back or should take back, is Tony and my fellow Marine General Officer Jim Mattis, who now commands the Central Command. During the march on Baghdad, he commanded the storied 1st Marine Division, which first won its laurels at Guadalcanal, continued through World War II, and Chosin Reservoir in Korea, and continued through all the wars that we fought and conflicts that we have since then. As he drove and led his Marines, he cried out, "Cut the tether of fuel," because what it was doing was it was pacing, forcing him to pace the operations that were he was conducting to get to Baghdad. When you go into Iraq, and I will always remember standing up on Aditha Dam in western Iraq and watching this Marine convoy of Humvees come back into the safe area, forward operating base, and looking down Euphrates. It's, you know, I grew up a Southern Baptist back in Tennessee, you know, and as I went to Sunday school, up on the walls would be, you know, pictures of the River Jordan, and that's what it looked like to me. But as the convoy wound around one of the corners, one of the biggest explosions I've ever seen in my life went off. Six 122-millimeter artillery rounds had been put together, and as the convoy went by, the bad guys cooked them all. 7 out of 10 of those convoys in Iraq, 7 out of 10 of those convoys in Afghanistan are carrying fuel and water. Every 25 or so of those convoys, casualties are produced. So we're not talking about just money, and it's significant because the fully burdened cost of getting fuel to a forward operating base in Afghanistan, some of the more remote, is $400 a gallon. It's what that purple stuff that Tony talked about. It's the price in blood that we have to pay to do this. So it's not only biofuel, it's solar. Marines are doing backpack solar in Afghanistan, micro wind generators, fuel cells, a myriad of things to reduce the cut that tethered that fuel has on our operations. You know, many have criticized the military for moving out an alternative fuel. I'm going to blame Senator Collins. She stole one of my little stories here in Politico last week. The Great White Fleet was built with steel that was produced domestically. And that steel cost $486 a ton. You could have bought it in Germany or in England for a third of that. But it was important to our country at that particular time that we developed a domestic steel industry that went on to support the winning of 2 world wars, the construction of our infrastructure like the Golden Gate Bridge. It was the right thing to do. And oh, by the way, you know, the senator talked about his good friend Senator McCain. One of the sailors, one of the officers that sailed in that Great White Fleet around the world when Teddy Roosevelt sent him was a Lieutenant McCain that went on to be an Admiral McCain, who was the grandfather of Senator McCain. So how does that relate to the civilian world? Well, back home in West Tennessee, I'm from a very rural area. I graduated in a class of 9 people, 6 girls and 3 boys. The numbers weren't very good, but I love the ratio. We have high unemployment. We need to create an infrastructure, and we have the pieces to do it. We have a great agricultural infrastructure where we can grow the feedstocks, we have wood chips, we have waste, we have all the things we need. And then on the other end of the scale, we have a market. The market is FedEx. Largest installation that FedEx has is in Memphis, Tennessee. And Fred Smith already said, hey, you know, when we get to the commercial viability of it, I'd like to put
a mix of biofuel in my jets, and that's a great idea. And Delta is a hub there, and we've got one of the largest concentrations of truck companies in the nation that could use biodiesel. And so we have an opportunity there to have a regional solution, to grow jobs, to increase the quality of life for those who live in the rural area of West Tennessee by producing a regional solution that has the feedstocks, that has the ability to turn it into biofuel, and then it has the ability. And as an aviator, you know, the only time that I've ever had too much gas was when I was on fire. The opportunity to turn that liquid fuel into gas by putting them in those airplanes and in those trucks and continuing to do that. So it doesn't look like that, you know, Green Fleet that's out off of Hawaii right now made up of two destroyers, a cruiser, and then the Nimitz, which is nuclear powered, but the airplanes are running on a mix just like the ships are of biofuel and jet fuel. And oh, by the way, this is not just America. Australian H-60 landed, hooked up, and it flew on biofuel as well. And this is something that is going to get traction as long as we stay on the glide slope that gets us to the end of this decade where we should be on a commercial scale in terms of biofuel production. Now, I look forward to your questions.
So one of the things we're doing today is releasing a letter. I think all of you have it in your press kit, which is signed by retired flag officers, certainly by generals here today, by Senator Warner and Representative Ike Skelton, two former chairmen of the Armed Services Committees. And it also includes a growing list of about 380 veterans from across the country. And the point of that letter is to simply tell the American people, the President and Congress, that continued DOD innovation is a strong imperative. It is necessary. It must continue. And so that's actually an ad in the Wall Street Journal, and we'll probably be running it in other places as well. But so you folks are on record. Anyway, with that all.
Did you say you had a copy of the journal with it?
Yep. Yes. Thanks, Tracy.
Perhaps you'd like to hold it.
Yeah. I was showing it off earlier, but I'm happy to show it off again. So here is a short version of the letter in the Wall Street Journal. I'll leave that here for anyone who wants to look at it.
Okay.
Would we like to go to questions?
Yes. I was wondering if you could sort of touch on the issue of climate change, which the three of you didn't touch on fully. And the reason I say that is because it seems to me it's a bit complicated as an issue, because if you do, I mean, the fact is that the biggest source of oil is Canada, 20-something percent, followed by Mexico, 30%. So these are 10% together for about 30%. So the U.S. is already getting off foreign oil from the Middle East. So is it important that it also gets off sources of energy that contribute to climate change? Is that also a security issue for the three of you?
Phyllis, why don't you take the climate change issue, because that's, you've been on that for many years, and bring it up to date.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, one of our partners in some of our work around the country has been the CNA Corporation and their military advisory board.
Sure, I'd like to hear from the principals, too, though. Thank you.
Now, thank you, Brian. Anything?
She wants to hear from you all.
I'll try to tackle a bit of that. I mean, climate change is important. You know, the Marine Corps is expeditionary, amphibious. It's ready to go today to today's crisis. And it has to go light, it has to go fast, and it has to carry sufficient punch. If you look at population increase, and you look at migrates towards great cities, which are usually on great transportation arteries, which usually are associated with rivers and bays and things like that, ports, where both air, rail, ships, you name it. And as the populations of the world, if you look around at this arc of from the North Africa all the way over to the Philippines, kind of an arc of potential problems, okay, you see that that's a great population increases going across there, settling in these coastal regions, which are going to be most affected by climate change as the ocean levels are predicted to rise. And living in Southern California, 12 miles from the coast, I kind of have a sense of that, and we discuss it in our civic, both our governmental organizations, migrating populations, and there's going to be less land, less opportunities can come about, which can bring about even greater crises. And so we kind of predict that the turmoil around these areas are going to be, whether it's natural disasters or whether it is actual conflict, that we're going to be more involved. And the strategic pipeline brought about by strategic problems brought about by climate change are going to make us perhaps even more active in the future. And as a result of helping, I mean, whether we're responding to a Haiti natural disaster, a man-made disaster of the Daiichi power plant and the tsunami, you know, Marines, sailors, soldiers, airmen have been at all of those things. And we kind of have a prediction that climate change and the rise of the oceans is going to exacerbate that. And so when you combine climate change with the logistics problems associated with fossil fuels, we've got some real potential for disasters or a lot more activity on the part of the Department of Defense.
Let me go at it this way, too. You know, when I got my commission, I just got married, and I told my wife, I said, honey, 3 years, and we're back on the farm, degrees in agriculture.
I said the same
thing. It took 36 to get back there, but, you know, I'm back on the farm, you know, and I've always kept my subscription to the Progressive Farmer Update, and I get the Fura and all these other Western vegetable grower, for instance, also. And each one of them in there says, hey, you know, well, one of the things we're going to have to do is we're going to have to breed a heat-tolerant wheat seed. Hey, you know, getting hotter. The others are saying, hey, you know, here's some great ways to improve your conservation measures because the storms are getting more intense. They're doing more damage to the land. So we've got... What I'm trying to say is, you know, the agricultural area, very conservative, acknowledges climate change is happening. Flip over to the military side. You know, one of my heroes, you know, people like Robert E. Lee, Patton, and others, okay, secret to their success was they did not make a decision after they had 100% surety that, hey, this is it. They said, hey, 70-80% is good enough, and I can act on that. And so, you know, I think most people realize that, you know, we're contributing to climate change. I think it's about 70-80% of certainty. There's enough there. Hey, we need to do something about it. And I think, you know, the military at least has acknowledged it. Hey, you know, 70% are certainty. And let's also do things that... that mitigate the potential increase that we're contributing from people.
I'd wrap up by saying the way we've approached it here at Pew is the energy program is the focal point, and it has a relevance to the ongoing analysis of climate variations, primarily in the production of the alternative fuels. We pretty well know what the effluent is with your coal, your fossil fuels, oil, and so forth like that. But we're now learning more about the impact on the environment as a consequence of fracking and natural gas in abundance today at lower cost today. The fuel that is the derivative in China, Canada from the shale, but the production of shale has some rather unique impacts on the effluent that comes out of that production. So the theme that we hit, DOD should be looking at the widest possible diversity of fuel sources and a cost analysis assigned to each. And today's meeting is to focus, we should continue to allow the department to move ahead with its innovations as it has since its origin in the Department of Defense. I was in it, privileged to be in it as Secretary of the Navy 30 plus years ago. We were doing innovations in those days. As a matter of fact, the Internet was somewhere buried down in there at the time that I was dealing with the problems associated with a very difficult combat situation in Vietnam. So, yes, climate change has a relevance, but the energy program has to go forward and is being driven by the necessity for the military to be at the ready 24/7. And they want the widest possible diversity of fuel sources.
You also mentioned Mexico and Canada, but that doesn't address price volatility, which is...
Oh, yes, the Middle East, which is a very significant
problem for the department. And,
yes.
So you just used the phrase the DoD should be looking at the widest possible array of energy sources, but they've moved beyond the state of looking with the DPA investment. That's making a clear investment. In your opening statements, you all made a good case for why the military is worried about energy, but I didn't hear a case for why biofuels are the answer right now. I know why biofuels are the answer for Tennessee, but I don't understand. I'm looking for why they're the answer for the military. Especially in light of the RAND study that came out in last year, in 2011, that addressed some concerns about the state of the industry as it stands right now, the state of Texas.
I think I've tried to lay the predicate down. Biofuel is not the, it is one of the potential sources. And right now, the military has proven its viability. The military has undergone the expenses associated with the R&D to determine its viability as a drop-in fuel. The experiments for the Great Green Fleet here, perhaps this gentleman could add a word to it, hadn't been there just 72 hours ago, that's the viability of the drop-in concept. And the drop-in was, in this instance, bio. So all we're saying is... continue to give the military the freedom it's exercised through all these many years of the history of the department, not just the current generation, but past generations, in innovating ways to solve problems here, innovating ways to solve their need for energy at the ready. I mean, it is there when we need it.
We burn 325,000 barrels of fuel in the military. 325,000 barrels of fuel a day.
A day.
Sorry.
Yeah. And let me add on to that because it's not, you know, there are two sides to this, okay? There are the warfighting requirement for alternatives. And then you got to remember we have all these bases and stations around the world. And how are they fueled? The families, you know, I mean, I had some 60,000 Marines and that number of family members living on my bases out west. Okay, so that's a lot of our fuel burn as well. A lot of our electrical requirements are just associated with the bases and stations. And so we have also not only developed, but also are employing alternative sources of energy. I mentioned the methane gas generated electric plant at Marine Carrier Station Miramar. They also get about 20% or 30% from solar panels. You'll go to any one of our bases and stations and you'll see more solar coming online. You'll also see a wind turbine at one of our bases in Barstow, California that produces about 20% of that base's electrical requirements. You'll see that the Navy is doing great exploration in China Lake on geothermal to power their electrical stations. So this is not just our operating forces, which is the key imperative, because the less we use here, the more resources we'll have for all our operational forces, which is the whole
reason for being. But at the same time, we're cutting down. I mean, if you go, we have fleets of white, what we call white vehicles. Okay, those are the vehicles that, you know, drove General Castle around, or the base electrician
well
uses. he drives himself now, or takes a cab, just like me. Yeah. and so we have these the white fleet on every base and station that helps maintain the base and station. We have vehicles powered by biofuels, electricity, hydrogen. We made a big mistake of powering some of our military police cars with hydrogen. And you get in a chase and it's like poof, you know, the guy steps on the accelerator and it doesn't accelerate like a gas fire. So we know so we had to take them out of the military police vehicles. But in our maintenance vehicles, if you go on a base, you'll see that we reduced in my first 2.5 years of this getting into this, following the Secretary's instruction, we reduced the amount of fossil fuel we use by 30% just by going to the alternative electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles. There's a combination in DOD of those types of vehicles. So, this goes a great beyond. It goes to our very infrastructure being redesigned. Okay? So, and that's already being employed. Okay. So biofuel is a viable alternative for the future, but it will be in combination with other things. And it's not like you're going to stop the use of fossil fuels instantaneously. But an add-on benefit is certainly whatever we're contributing to polluting the air and increasing our carbon footprint, reducing that as a result.
So the military needs a certain amount of money, and Admiral Green has put in here a relatively small amount, to finish their test and evaluation program. Then it's got to be up to the industrial base and other civilian potential users to begin to develop a market which will enable the Department of Defense to continue to access the bio. I wonder if our representative of the bio industry, who just got back from the Great Green Fleet, do you agree with that now? We have proven it works. Now we've got to get that cost structure down such that Congress is comfortable. Just say that respectfully of the Congress as it guards the expenditure of taxpayer funds.
All right. Well, I think you're right on. You know, the context that we like to give is that the evolution of the petroleum refinery took 150 years to get us where we are today. Biofuels already are playing a significant role in the vehicle market from ethanol, but, you know, we've really only seen an investment in the R&D for military applications over the past really three, four years. So it's only a matter of time before those technologies are there and they're competitive. But the question is, do we have the time to wait? And what DOD can do is contribute to accelerating the timeline to commercialization. And the R&D and the DPA's role in terms of overcoming the valley of death in getting from lab to commercial, you know, that's the key role.
Well, that convergence point of we finished the test and evaluation, it worked, and the industry being able to come in and produce the quantities in sufficient amounts, not just to meet the military, but really the larger consumers, say the air, commercial air and other buyers. That's the only thing that's going to bring that price down.
Can we go to a question on the phone, and then we'll come to you, Keith?
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key. That's star one on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they receive. If you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, you can press star two. Our first question comes from Jill Buck from Go Green Radio.
Yes, thank you. General Cheney, perhaps with your ag background, you may be able to answer this best. One of the concerns that many folks have about biofuels is their water intensity, and as the nation is in a period of drought at this point, is there any concern about requisite water infrastructure expenditures in order to mitigate the effects that climate change-related drought or just, you know, regular drought may have on the production of biofuels for this purpose?
Thank you, Castillo. The source of biofuels is across the spectrum. While agricultural, particularly the University of Tennessee in my home area, is doing a lot of work with switchgrass. And that switchgrass can be grown on more marginal land. It does not impact the normal food crops, for instance. A lot of work being done with wood chips. And then we just talked about, before we came in here, of using waste to produce it. Algae is also, and a lot of the biofuel that's being used by the Green Strike Group out in Hawaii now is algae-based. So there is a number, a variety of sources that can be used depending on what the viability and what the impact is that you get on the second and third effort. So if we were to have a situation where water is an issue, then we have a number of other sources.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. One thing I was hoping gentlemen could help me understand, and it's kind of an eloquent testimony to this fact today. We've got three Marine Corps folks here. You've all made reference to the fact that DOD as a whole is sort of undertaking these initiatives, and yet whenever you look around, it's always spearheaded by the Marine Corps. The Navy's very much in a leadership role. Army's kind of MIA, and the U.S. Air Force seems to have a little bit of daylight on this issue with the Navy, and I was hoping you could address that. In terms of, you know, is there unanimity among the different services in terms of the all energy imperatives, you know, first of all? And second, if you care to speculate, you mentioned Madison, his famous, you know, tether line. Zilmer back in Iraq did the same thing. Bob Charette now is doing the same stuff. Why is the Marine Corps, the guys at the sharpest end of the stick, seem to be the most enthusiastic about this?
Well, I'm senior, I'll start.
That's exactly right.
Well, Brutus Bob Charette runs the Marine Corps Expeditionary Fuels. And
exceptional man, really. Really is a great professional.
Yeah, he's a Hornet driver and a great, and what he's been given a mission to do. And the Marines, you know, you give them a mission, and we're going to go out and do the best we can. But having said that, I, as a Marine, I say the Navy has been in the lead on this. What you've seen, you got guys like Tom Hicks, who's been a player. The Navy has gone from sails to steam to nuclear power. They've been at the forefront of these innovations. So, Marines, are accused by Pershing or try to keep in the background because we had such a media machine even during World War I. And so sometimes I think that we are seen as a little bit larger than we actually are. And this is a case, I think, where the Navy is doing much more in terms of they're the ones that are certifying the airplanes. They're the ones that are certifying the ships. They're the ones that are building the hybrid drives that you're seeing. The Air Force is doing it too. You know, they're certifying the A-10s, F-15s, F-16s.
Well, there's a great number of platforms in the Air Force. I mean, I just have to take issue with the Air Force might be dragging their feet. I think they were just looking at just airborne vehicles.
They're putting solar panels on their housing. The Army just created a Clean Warrior outfit in Michigan at one of their labs. As we look at the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle program, one of the areas that they're looking at is how we can make it more efficient. You know, as we increase the armor, as we increase the size, with the miles per gallon have gone down. So as we look at vehicles, the Army always leads in that particular area for the services, so they're looking at how they can be more efficient. I already talked about Fort Leonard Wood, where the Army is teaching Marines and soldiers net zero installations. 25 of those Army installations are net zero, which means no energy is coming in. So it's across the Department of Defense. As I said, sometimes the Marines, because we've got really spiffy uniforms, are the ones that are seen.
Lastly, I was a part of the congressional scene when we established in the Pentagon Sharon Burke's division, and she's the first appointee, and I think it's just done a splendid job thus far in coordinating the efforts of the branches, trying to remove any duplication costs, let each do their own thing, but do it in such a way that we're not going to be duplicate of some of the R&D and other expenditures.
Well, when I was in my previous assignment, I would get together with Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and the civilian community writ large on this very issue, and how how it impacted on the civilian community around us. So you had to bring in industry as well as governmental, both local government and federal agencies in on it. And DOD was Assistant Secretary Mike Conger, C-O-N-G-E-R, was the chairman of that group, which we so. I always looked at it as kind of a joint fight in terms of where we're going to go. We had the five governors of the southwestern states from New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, California, and Utah. We would all meet once a year. Matter of fact, the next meeting is in September in Sacramento. Last year it was in Salt Lake City. The previous year it was in Albuquerque. And so this is a much larger issue than that, and the impacts of it are much larger than. And I think General Castable's answer is right. And remember that all these programs that the Marine Corps does are generally speaking funded by Navy dollars or Army dollars. You know, but we're given our slice of that pie to innovate because we are, I mentioned in my opening remarks, a very light expeditionary force. So we have to tailor ourselves to move out very quickly. So we're not the United States Army, and we don't claim to be, because they carry a real powerful punch. We carry that medium punch. It gets there quick, but we hope they're
could I add also
they're pretty fast.
Also, that what the military DOD has done has all been in open literature, shared by our industrial base, as they may be able to utilize it, and many communities that are in the proximity of bases have picked up ideas and incorporated in their own community life. Am I not correct?
And the universities, and I see it in the universities too, this whole idea of algae production. I go over to the University of California, San Diego, and I sit with their professors and talk about, what is the Marine Corps, what is the Army, what is the Navy, how can this, they've got all of these, they're just producing this algae that has a whole bunch of what I would call oil in it, and so it is big. Industry is involved in it, universities are involved in it, and we're just setting the what is the standard, what is the requirement to fly an F-18 fighter jet on either biofuels or some reusable research elements that we're using. So it's a wide partnership, I'd say.
Let's just go down here. You and me.
Yeah, great. So I understand that this letter is about looking at specifically the DOD and continuing their...
Can you raise your voice just a little bit?
Yeah, I understand that this is looking at the DOD specifically continuing their program, as you mentioned, sort of through the next decade. But to get to that commercialization stage and to really have this energy security we're talking about requires the commercialization. How important are the other policies that are also being also controversial on the Hill right now? The RFS is being heavily debated. How does the military link up with some of those efforts in industry, and is this a united front? You work with the biofuel manufacturers on these issues on the Hill, or are these totally separate?
Sure, I have an answer.
I'm not on the Hill very much like it.
I think afterwards you could probably talk to Matt and he could give you a good sense of where the RFS is and how these policies.
So these are separate in your mind. Yeah.
I'll go to Andrew and then Dave.
Thanks for doing this. You had mentioned earlier the politicization of some of these issues on Phyllis, you mentioned your frustration with that. I wonder if any of you would like to kind of expand on that a little bit and kind of get up a sense of what is at risk here in this political debate that's kind of forming around these issues.
Phil, that's your part.
Well, I guess from my point of view, and I guess he's asking for you all to chime in, so if you feel comfortable, do so. But, you know, this looks to us, when you look at energy innovation and the Department of Defense, these issues shouldn't be close. They are about operational risk. They're about saving taxpayer dollars. And a role that the Department of Defense has done for decades, as I think all the both generals and Senator Warner have talked about today. So this isn't a role that's new. It's not a role that I would say is particularly risky. And so to the extent that we can, I think we ought to kind of just protect DOD innovation going forward. And so that's why to have some of these innovations kind of singled out is unfortunate. And we're hoping that throughout the process that we're going to see changes to current proposed amendments or bills and have the opportunity to really encourage Department of Defense innovation going forward. And I think, you know, in some of this legislation there are going to have to be changes. As you know, one of the amendments that has been adopted by the Senate Armed Services Committee would, in fact, outlaw fuels that are in use now, particularly in unmanned vehicles, and would seriously constrain the ability of the Department of Defense and the Navy to kind of move forward.
I think that was unintentional in a draft and proper use of
right.
English language
right.
in describing what they told us.
Right. But that just goes to the point that there are going to have to be changes made to the legislation, and so we hope that there are opportunities to really kind of protect these investments going forward. And I think the Department of the Navy would say that, you know, the investment, or I don't know if Admiral Greener addressed this, but it's 0.6% of what DOD spends on fuel. So it's a small investment for a potentially big payoff. Anyone else?
You did a good job.
Oh, well, thank you.
We lined up behind you.
On the biofuels and research and development piece of this, why is it important that this be done through the military as opposed to being done through the Department of Energy or USDA? And also, someone mentioned price volatility a while ago. How is this going to resolve your price volatility issue? You're not looking at enough to really influence the grand scheme of total energy, right?
Well, I think, first of all, that there is a partnership. One of the great partnerships that are underway on this is between the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Defense, with the Navy being the lead on this. And so, you know, everybody's throwing in a little money. The commercial sector is throwing in money. And together, we're developing this. You know, Fort Myers over here, when Wright Brothers brought an airplane over, got Army Aviation got involved in trying to develop that and got crashed, killed him at Fort Myers over there. So, I mean, you know, we've been involved in this because a lot of times there is not the business case at the initial point for doing this. And you're talking about super conducting wires. We've already talked about the internet, certain metals, and so forth. So this is an opportunity to leverage a requirement, which is for the military increase combat capability by reducing the reliance on fuel, by reducing the volatility of price, $3 billion extra dollars were the cost because of Iran's efforts last year. By being able to leverage that, the R&D, the developments, and that partnership, then you kickstart it. The other part is, and I mentioned it, 325,000 barrels of fuel. That's a lot of fuel, you know. 80% of the energy the Department of Defense uses is liquid. So we're a market mover. Okay, why not have a situation where, hey, as we have done for other things in the past, let's have somebody that you can depend on buying the stuff. Let's do stuff about, hey, let's increase the length of time that we can have the contracts to buy the petroleum. Let's have organizations like Byrant and others in the biofuel business give them some kind of predictability so that they can make the private investments that are needed to do that. So you know, to me, this is something that's happened before on other stuff. It's been a public-private partnership. The military has been involved in it ever since, you know, the beginning. So it just seems to make sense, and everybody has a little bit of a stakeholder in this, and we all come out winners.
Well, one thing I would just, and one of the things we also do is chronicle private investment among G20 nations in clean energy. And what we know from all of our research over several years is that if there is a question of uncertainty when it comes to policy, private investment will move to somewhere, to another country where there is policy certainty. And at the moment, we are the world's leader in attracting private capital to alternative fuels. And if there is a whole lot of uncertainty, we are going to lose a lot of that private capital, which could significantly set back the industry. So part of this is just about sending that that signal of certainty to the private sector so they can invest the level of
signal. I want to come back to two points. The military do not have the option of, you know, bad snowstorm, we're going to close the school for 3 days. Got floods over here, we're going to close this for 2 days. They've got to be 24/7 at the ready. Our command posts, which are monitoring signals all over the world, have got to have power that's consistent. So they don't have the option of closing down for a few days or ceasing to perform their function. Now, as you get, the key question is, at what juncture in the bio industry does the cost, and Congress has a responsibility to monitor those costs, have to shift to industry? And this is what the Admiral, Chief of Naval Operations, said 6 days ago. Navy intends to purchase alternative fuels for operational use only as capitalized product at prices competitive with traditional fossil fuels. That message simply says, let us finish our R&D, where we're having to pay higher prices. But once we've proven the case, we got to partner with the industrial base and other segments of the government to make it, as he says right here, prices competitive with traditional fossil fuels.
If no one else had anything, I wanted to follow up actually on Annie's question about, you know, why biofuels now? Because one of the things you hear a lot from Secretary Mabus, you hear, from pretty much everybody, is the Navy leads the propulsion revolutions, coal to oil to nuclear. This is in our DNA. We do it all the time. It always brings benefits. Except all of these other prior propulsion revolutions brought immediate operational advantages that overwhelmed any sort of the trade-offs that you had. Whether it was, higher speeds, ability to refuel at sea, the long term with the nuclear. No one has been able to explain what the operational benefits of biofuels, either for your airframes or for your ships, are. You still got liquid fuel, you still have your oilers. In fact, you have a smaller potential base of production opportunities. So I'm just kind of curious if anyone could explain, what the operational benefits of moving to more biofuels are, and if that might be part of the problem in getting more buy-in here.
Well, it's directly tied to the logistics chain. And if you're using less fuel, you're dragging less with you, whether you're operating as a fleet or trying to resupply our forces in Afghanistan through that perilous road route, other means to get the supplies there. So I think it's a direct correlation between operations and reducing. That's why we're going to the various, I mentioned the ships that are being altered in terms of their operating power, propulsion systems, going to electric drive and other things. All of that to relieve the dependence on fuel and to use less of it, to transport less of it.
Yeah, I believe it, even at the time of the Civil War, when we had the Monitor and the Merrimack going at it down in Hampton Roads, there were still sailing ships around there, so it didn't happen overnight. It took a period to do it. And growing up, I can remember, I was at the end of the, when we still had mules. I'll tell you what, nothing clears your mind about the future than being on the south end of a northbound mule. and we were still working. It wasn't because the tractors or anything were cheaper. The mules were. It was just it took a long time to do the transition. So I think each one of those have, and if anybody's ever read about Hammond Rickover and how long it took and what the battles were to get nuclear power into some of the things. So, you know, I don't see a whole lot of difference, at least to me, and of course, you know, I'm an old farmer, that between what's going on now and what's going on in the past.
But isn't one of the most compelling arguments right cost? Because in 2005, the DOD purchased 130 million barrels. That cost them $8.6 billion. And 3 years later, they cost they purchased $134 million, and it cost them $17.9 billion. And I think most experts would say that the cost of oil is going up, not down, with demand. And so this is really about protecting the budget in addition to protecting the operation. But
yeah, it's kind of like when I was in high school paying 26 cents a gallon gas. Now, what's the percentage increase over the last 40-plus years? You know, what's the price of gas? By the time we get development in this, what's the price of gasoline really going to cost? Now, I told my son this last weekend, I said, son, now think, when I was your age, I was paying, you know, from 30 to like 27, okay? Okay. Multiply that times 13, 14, you get what paying now. Now, you pay, multiply 14 times 4. But he's my age. Now, if we can do this development and drive down the cost of buying, we put another competitor in the market. Every time you get a new competitor in the market, it's like the first calculator I got in 1976, hand calculator. It could do algebra. It cost, I said $495 yesterday. My wife corrected me on the phone last night. It was $295. But this calculator, all it could do was algebra, right? Next year, because Texas Instruments started out with it, and then somebody else jumped on it. And the next year, they were giving them away at the bank for opening up a $5 checking account. But the first year, it did cost $295. And now they don't exist. Okay? So, you know, this whole idea of this is the price now in research and development, as opposed to what it's going to cost the consumer, taxpayers, in the future, it's a ludicrous argument. What was the cost of the first nuclear reactor to power the first sub, which then creates now, what percentage of the U.S. electrical grid? Okay.
Our 20% of nuclear power.
Right. So you take that. It all started with the Nautilus. We've mentioned that before. No Nautilus, no nuclear power grid in our grid right now. Okay. So, yeah, I don't like to get into the politics of it, the question about politics, but from a common sense perspective, and going back to what are we doing for the next generation's relief? What are we doing? The wealthiest country in the world, what is it doing? And this has impact on climate change and all these other things that we've addressed here. But what are we doing just in this? And it's a combination of biofuels and others.
You know, I've been out there on the hustings for 30 years as a member of Congress. And it's tough to stand there in the presence of a group of farmers and say that, well, I hear you're spending $15 on this special fuel, you know, and that congressperson has got the answer, yes. But that fuel is necessary to maintain a diversity now and in the future. And in the future, we are going to get that 15 down in partnership with the industry. So I can understand their scrutinizing and that their responsibility, these cost structures. But we've got to go back and, as these gentlemen have said most eloquently, look at the historical base of this country and how we have always allowed the soldier, sailor, airman, and marine. They're some of the most creative minds in America, either a general or a flag officer or a lowly sergeant like I was. I may not be smart, but anyway, the rest of my army were darn smart. But they come up with ideas, and you've seen how many examples of how the Marines have taken those little blankets they got, the solar blankets. Well, they got to be very popular when they realized they could hook repower the cell phones and talk to their girlfriends back home. They were glad to put them in the rucksack and carry their weights. And you saw that in the communities that you served in, how the communities are coming on the base. Oh, you're going to do that? Well, we're going to do that in us. So it's all a learning process.
Okay. Well, I'm conscious, I'm aware of all your times and conscious. Are there any other questions? No? Okay.
Thanks
for coming.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
thanks, Katie. Yeah.
Thank you, Nam.
Thanks, everyone on the phone.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines now.